вдруг, как в сказке, скрипнула дверь. Все мне ясно стало теперь. Столько лет я спорил с судьбой ради этой встречи с тобой. Мерз я где-то, плыл за моря, знаю, это было не зря. Все на свете было не зря, не напрасно было.
Howdy, folks. Welcome back to The Russia Guy. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, and this is the podcast. This is a podcast where I talk about Russian news, politics, and culture. You know this. I interview various journalists, academics, and activists doing, they're doing interesting things in the field. That's why I'm talking to them. On today's show, my guest is Matthew Luxmore, a Moscow-based correspondent for RFERL, that's Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who covers Russia and the former Soviet Union. And he was kind enough to come on this podcast to talk about an article he wrote way back in March. In fact, this interview was recorded sometime in mid-April, and it's taken me about a month just to get it together and put it out. So sorry about that, everybody. Matt's report is about a man in Novosibirsk named Denis Karagodin, an amateur researcher who spent the better part of a decade compiling archival documents about the murder of his great-grandfather back in 1938 by officers in the NKVD, which is the predecessor of the KGB. Earlier this year, the local authorities reportedly started building a criminal case against Karagodin on defamation charges brought by relatives of some of his grandfather's supposed executioners. This story gets into how Russia deals with the legacy of the Stalinist repressions, what Russians consider to be acceptable amateur sleuthing when it comes to these sorts of criminal matters, and what you can actually learn about Russia's security apparatus and its Soviet past by working in its archives. That and more in the interview. Now, here it is. It makes for interesting reading, right? Because when I read the article, I was thinking like, I wonder what Matt would have asked him if that had contributed to the article. But you did talk to him, so my question was going to be, what would you have asked him? Can you tell me what you did ask him without quoting him? What he said? Or
yeah, sure. He and I have had a few conversations, mainly exchanges on Telegram, but also a couple of calls.
I see.
Obviously, now he's, he's in pre-investigation phase. So I think he's also a bit careful about what he tells the press. And he's generally, quite reluctant, I think, to talk to the press. It's kind of a bit complicated, because on one hand, he talks to Echo Moskvy and Dorsch, I think, on a Echo Moskvy on a very regular basis. So, one of the biggest kind of liberal-minded radio stations in Russia. But at the same time, he doesn't want to say too much about the case because now he faces criminal charges. But in our conversations, he came across very much the way he comes across in all of his interviews with Echo, the radio station, and other interviews he's given on Medusa's podcast also. He's kind of this dogged, determined campaigner who's been at this for the last 9 years, kind of doggedly researching the death of his great-grandfather and finding the names of the people he claims are responsible for his great-grandfather's murder, right, during the Stalin era in 1938. So, he's very much, he likes to say that he welcomes this criminal investigation, which is not usually what you'd hear from people, facing criminal charges in Russia. And the reason he welcomes the criminal investigation, which makes the story a lot more interesting for journalists especially, is he sees it as an opportunity to use a platform to basically push his claims, or claims is perhaps a bit unfair to him, but the evidence, the huge amount of evidence he's gathered relating to this murder of his great-grandfather. So he actually wants to, this is perhaps the most amazing part, he wants to use this criminal investigation to introduce these documents into the criminal trial to then basically shed light on this murder. And a lot of people in Russia, especially people who think it shouldn't be taboo to discuss these topics, you know, about the dark pages of Russia's past, very much kind of welcome his investigation, because they kind of applaud him as someone who has basically done what Russia has unfortunately failed to do, which is kind of conclusively, I guess, reach closure on these chapters of his past and maybe have a very kind of open discussion on it, which it had in the 90s, but it doesn't. Definitely not to the same extent today.
And in this, in your story, so you mentioned that, you know, he's sort of eager to put these documents even more in the public. I mean, he already has been sharing them online for years now, but I guess it would be even more exposure to have them admitted as evidence in a trial or something like that.
I was going to say, I think he's supremely confident, maybe rightly or wrongly, but I mean, he got these documents from the FSB, you know. The reason he got these documents, and, you know, the documents do name the three people who, you know, directly murdered his great-grandfather, and they name his great-grandfather's name among, you know, 36 names of people who were shot that day in Tomsk. And the reason he's so confident is because, you know, I guess as he has hinted, the FSB has perhaps launched this case or is overseeing this case, and it's the same agency that provided these documents to him. So I think he's quite confident that he has a strong case to defend himself.
Just out of curiosity, why are there three people that are directly responsible for executing him? I mean, why isn't it just one executioner?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the one person pulled the trigger, but the document that basically proclaims that this order that was given to shoot these 36 prisoners was carried out is signed by three people. So I guess we don't know who actually pulled the trigger.
Is this the same document that in your article you cite Jan Rachinsky, I think is how you say his name, who's at Memorial, if I'm right?
Rachinsky, exactly.
Yeah, he's arguing, he told you apparently that Karagodin, he seemed to criticize Karagodin, saying that he lacks the sort of necessary archival training, and that he's interpreting this one document that as a sort of smoking gun. But he says that actually this is kind of like a common thing that was drafted maybe even years after the execution was carried out. And so is that the same document? Are we talking about the same document right now?
No, I think what Rachinsky was referring to is the document that was signed by Mitushov, who is the father of the person who launched the first complaint against Karagodin, which led to, you know, an administrative case, as you call it in Russia, not the criminal case. So there are two cases against him. So that document was signed by Mitushov, and Rachinsky says that Mitushov was most likely just a simple clerk. He was someone who, after the fact, did the administrative work that collated all these different documents and signed off saying, you know, this particular event took place at this time. So most likely he never had any involvement in the murder. But Karagodin, I think, has this view that anyone who was part of the NKVD at the time, just like liberals say, I guess, about people who work in the government today, perhaps not liberals is not the right word, but Putin critics. Karagodin thinks that anyone who works in the NKVD had, you know, is culpable, is complicit in the murder of the people who were, who, you know, fell victim to, you know, the Great Terror.
I see. So this kind of gets into a lot of the politics of language, I guess. When he calls this person a murderer, he's not literally saying this guy pulled the trigger. He's saying he's morally culpable.
Yeah, exactly. He has this chapter on his website, which is just meticulously curated with hyperlinks everywhere. And it's a very impressive piece of work. But he has this chapter, one of the tabs in his website, which is titled Murderers, right? Ubitsy. And Mitushov is listed there not as the murderer, but as someone who, in Karagodin's words, is partly responsible or is complicit in the murder. So I guess you know, that's where the complications arise with terminology and how Karagodin wants to phrase these things and how other people would rather have it phrased.
I mean, at first glance, the idea of pressing felony charges against somebody for I'm trying to think of like in American history, or I guess just like Western history, and I don't know if there's an easy one at hand. Well, I mean, like, let's, I don't know, I'm going to get a bit theoretical here, but let's say in the United States, at least, like, probably the closest, like, comparison I can make would be, like, something to do with slavery. And so let's say, like, somebody's investigating the people that enslaved their, you know, great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather or something, and they think they've identified, you know, some descendant of their slave owner or something, and then they have a blog, essentially, where they call out people for enslavement or racism. And somebody then, I mean, this is that, do you think that, does that kind of like, in the context of like American history, is that like a somewhat fair
analogy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for lack of an accurate one, I think that's, that's probably the most accurate analogy in terms of having, you know, an event in America's past that the country definitely still hasn't reached closure on,
right,
which is in some way comparable to the event in Russia. Obviously Russia has serfdom, right? Its own form of you know, slavery. So but yeah, the Great Terror, I think, has the same perhaps place in the Russian psyche,
right?
You know, at least as far as we can compare.
Now, in terms of like the of how popular Karagodin's sort of campaign is, I guess I'd like to know like what you think the kind of common Russians assessment of it is, because recently there was this this article, I think it was published in Projekt by sociologist Grigory Yudin, and he did focus groups and he did, I think, just some polling, and he asked people, I have to look at the article again to see if he mentioned Karagodin specifically, but it was clearly, his case clearly informed some of the questions that he asked people. And one of them was, if you believe you've kind of collected enough archival data to prove that that some past NKVD agent, you know, killed your relative in the terror, is it okay to come out publicly and accuse those people of being murderers? And I think it was something like almost 70% of people said only once you go through the courts. And so it's a very kind of, they had a very legalistic interpretation of what, when it was acceptable to call somebody a killer or a murderer. I mean, again, like if we play the analogy of instead of the terror, it's slavery, there probably would be a lot of Americans who'd be like, well, don't call my relatives bad words. Like, you can't accuse them of crimes until you've proven it. So now I'm kind of rethinking my question initially, because my initial question was going to be, that sounds absurd to an American. Of course, you should be able to name and shame your relatives' killers. But I guess, like, what's your assessment of how this plays out in Russia?
Yeah, I mean, what's been really interesting with this case is the kind of state media coverage of it.
Yeah.
You know, you'll often see this with, for instance, the case of Yuri Dmitriev, who's this kind of amateur historian who discovered Gulag burial sites, published the names of, you know, thousands of victims, people who were buried there, and now, you know, then was slapped with what his supporters definitely say are fabricated charges that he sexually abuses adopted daughters. So it's a really grim case. But he was also, you know, someone who dug into Russia's past, you know, obviously the case has progressed far further than Karagozin's, and Karagozin's trial, if it happens, will probably be open, because it's not, you know, child abuse or another crime that usually mandates a closed court. But there have been discussions in, you know, the Russian state media that have been fairly balanced. I mean, very balanced by the standards of Russian state media. There were pseudo discussions on these talk shows, which are usually, you know, pretty kind of vile affairs where people scream at each other about Ukraine. And you know how bad America is and all this kind of stuff. And when they were talking about Karagodin, there were, you know, people, even the pundits who usually just say kind of indefensible things about all kinds of topics, spoke quite favorably of him and said he actually has the right to do this. The signal may come once he is kind of proclaimed a persona non grata, or, you know, someone who should not be defended anymore, and the tone could quite rapidly change, as it did with Dmitriev, who's just faced you know, just a complete propaganda onslaught, as have other, you know, people in, you know, that have been kind of subjected to major legal cases like Navalny.
Right.
So, yeah, I've been quite surprised by that. And obviously the kind of liberal contingent, as the media likes to call them, but the people who generally are critical of the government and that whole media infrastructure, they've been very positive about Karagozin. They've interviewed, you know, lots of journalists have interviewed him far more than on, you know, Russian state media, right. And he's been given a chance, he's been given a platform to kind of outline his views. And people, a lot of people praise that, those who praise him for the fact that he's done what, as I mentioned earlier, what a lot of people haven't done, and what Russia as a country hasn't done, definitely not to the extent that these people would like to have it be done, right? Which is to kind of really reach some closure on those chapters of the past, especially at a time when lots of young people, at least surveys show, lots of like young people, you know, don't even know what the Gulag was.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure in America, perhaps, you know, some chapters of the past or some
sure.
Particular events, a lot of people wouldn't know about as well. So I'm definitely not making that comparison.
Sure.
But that is kind of instructive.
Does he frame his own activities in any kind of political context? Does he, I mean, if he's speaking to these, you know, I'm using air quotes, liberal media outlets consistently.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I would imagine that they're probably hoping he will aligned with them, and I wonder, have you noticed him doing that, or is he sticking to sort of, you know, because it seems to me the grassroots initiatives that succeed in Russia are the ones that do not attach themselves to any kind of overt political campaigns.
Yeah, exactly. Especially right now, it's very dangerous to, you know, start speaking publicly against the government.
Right.
So no, I think he's been quite tactful in that sense. He's been pretty reserved in his comments about Putin. And I don't think he's been called to make any comments mm-hmm. about Putin. Not that Putin is directly related in this case, as far as we know, or the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. But no, he's been really focused on the case. And I think he genuinely sees this as his chance to reach a bigger audience. He's very much focused on reaching a bigger audience. I mean, he calls himself on his website, you know, a lobbyist and an influencer. And he republishes, you know, any interview that's written about him. So he welcomes the attention.
I see.
Maybe not as much for personal reasons as just as a way to bring attention to, you know, this case, which he's been working on for ages.
Is it always his case, or has he expanded to helping, you know, other people discover their relatives and cover the killers?
That's a good question. I haven't actually asked him that question, but I know that Memorial helps people, and there's been kind of something close to kind of a spike in cases of people turning to Memorial and the Gulag Museum in Moscow, which does this too. People turning to them, asking them for help in getting documents. Mm-hmm. I think Karagodzin was pretty unique in getting these documents from the FSB, and I think he waited a very long time. I don't think the FSB is, you know,
right.
particularly kind of trigger happy in releasing these documents to people. So he's done very well in that sense. But there are other people who do this kind of stuff. But I think he's definitely the most high profile and controversial at the same time, because you know, historians do say that he just doesn't have this, he doesn't do the same due diligence.
So in terms of the perspective or the pre-investigative case that they're apparently have opened against him, it has to do with it's being pursued on these grounds of privacy violations. And I thought I'd ask you about this because it's in the news. Police raided the apartment of Roman Onion or Anin, I'm not sure how you say his last name, but he's the iStories, or Vajna. So it's Important Stories, I guess. Important Stories. Although I guess the case concerns an article that he wrote when he was back at Novaya Gazeta, and it has to do with Igor Sechin's now ex-wife and Instagram post that she had revealing that they used to hang out on a very, very expensive yacht that even on the Rosneft salary wouldn't have been affordable. But the case seems to be, it's a privacy violation thing. And it's the same thing that we're seeing now with Karagodin. And I wonder, just reporting from Moscow on Russia, privacy is one of these things that it seems like the political elite and the upper class in general, they're kind of wielding it more, I guess I would say. They're wielding their privacy protections more lately. It's another justification, I guess, for the fact that they've concealed a lot of the property records, or they're concealing, and they're making it harder to get access to these things that have been fueling a lot of investigative reporting over the last few years, right? There's the Spark Interfax database is something that investigative reporters, you know, they use constantly in their articles, and there've been some laws recently to make it harder to kind of populate that database with the asset information that, you know, has made it easy to connect a lot of dots and so on. So I guess, in the context of the Karagodin preliminary case, what's the kind of role of like privacy that you're seeing in news stories from the, you know, the, in recent memory.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if those, if Karagodzin's case is kind of part of this trend where, you know, the ability of journalists to mine, you know, what's called Probiv, right, and these other databases that give information on government officials, which have been, you know, access to that has been restricted.
Yeah.
But I do think, more broadly speaking, my sense is we're just in a time right now in Russia where, you know, there is a pretty concerted and pretty all-encompassing kind of campaign to rein in dissent and, you know, prevent the kind of protests that we saw in January. So, and again, Karagozhin is a fairly unique case because he isn't part of the opposition. He, so far as I know, and also in contrast to Dmitriev, who openly and publicly criticized the government, I haven't seen those kinds of statements from Karagodzin. So I guess, you know, there's different theories about this case. I mean, one would be that he just fell, you know, under this kind of dragnet where, you know, all kinds of absurd cases are being launched against government critics across Russia, some absurd ones, some slightly less absurd, and some very, very serious, like the Anyim case. And, you know, another possibility is this kind of historical politics thing, which I think is probably less convincing, which is, you know, that people who research Russia's past are, you know, just being silenced. Would be a great story, but I'm not quite sure if we can, if there's enough evidence to claim that. I mean, obviously, Memorial as an organization has been heavily targeted in recent years as well, so that might add ammunition to that story. But and then the third one is just that these are local, with the Dmitriev and Karagozhin cases, these are just local campaigns that were launched by some local officials against people who annoyed them. Dmitriev definitely annoyed a lot of people, and Karagozhin, even by his nature, you know, he's very outspoken. He is you know, he doesn't seem to back down. I can also imagine that he annoyed some people, especially the people whose relatives he tied to these murders. So, yeah, I'm not really convinced by the kind of Anyim analogy and whether Karagodzin can be fitted into that trend. But I do think that, you know, a lot of people would say if they want you to stop doing the work you've been doing, then they might be able to find a case against you. So they'll find something to basically leverage against you in the courts. And that seems to have been the case of Anyim. I mean, it's a pretty sad trend that we're seeing, you know, these cases against journalists recently. That seems to be an escalation.
Do you think that historians have any reason to fear, the ones that, you know, say go to Russia to do archival work, whether you're talking about domestic Russian historians or folks coming from abroad to work in archives? Because I know that when you see the headline, you know, some guy's being prosecuted or investigated because he got an archival document and posted it online, a lot of people who work in archives are probably like, ooh, is that going to be a problem?
I mean, I don't think that, you know, foreign researchers are under any great threat in Russia, or definitely that we haven't reached that stage yet. But I'm definitely not, I wouldn't call myself an expert on that topic. But I would say that, you know, it is a very tense climate right now politically in Russia. So I think some people who, you know, some people might be thinking twice about doing certain things among people who are government critics,
right?
Just because of the repercussions that, you know, a lot of people have faced. I mean, especially supporters of Navalny. And again, whether we can fit the Karagodzin case or even the Anyim case into that, you just don't know in Russia, right? Until maybe a few years later, when all the documents come out and we know, you know, who ordered certain cases, if the cases were ordered, and you know, who's involved in them.
But your impression of what he's, because you said he's like, he's sort of welcomed this pre-investigative check, and he's welcomed, you know, like the attention from law enforcement as an opportunity to just make his case again and more, you know, in a new venue and so on. But to your knowledge, he has not said, oh, this is the Kremlin coming after me again. Because that's something that you see a lot of times, like with Anand, for instance, and with other reporters, a lot of times when they're asked, you know, why do you think you've been targeted by with police harassment, my impression is often what I'll read is people saying, oh, well, you know, you don't always know where it's coming from, but in this case, I think it's from the very top because, you know, look at how important this work is that I'm doing, that kind of thing. So his response is not so much like, oh, this is the machine coming for me. He doesn't necessarily address why they're coming for him. He just sort of embraces it as, listen to what I got, everybody. That's kind of how you would describe his reaction.
Well, I think, yeah, probably, yeah. And I think one of the reasons is because this guy who filed the complaint that led to the first case, Mitushov, which is a slander case, he actually gave an interview to a Belarusian TV channel, which is not usually what you see in these cases. I mean, the Dmitriev case, for example, it was an anonymous tip-off that led to his prosecution. So, you know, you never find out who the person who actually, you know, filed the first complaint is. And in this case, the guy actually made an interview. I haven't seen him speak anywhere since, and I tried to contact him and to no avail. But no, Karagodin, I think, he's hinted that it's coming from above. But again, I can't cite any specific statements that I've seen him make publicly.
Sure.
And I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth. So I'm sure he has his own opinions about that. But what's really interesting in this kind of the way he ties these different threads together, as I mean, to give you an example, he's publishing the photographs and names and professional details of all the people who are involved in the current investigation against him in the same style on his website, that he publishes the names and faces and biographical details of the people that he says were involved in his great-grandfather's murder. So he's tying these different threads together. And I mean, when I first saw that, my first impression was, you know, that could definitely ruffle some feathers.
Sure.
You know, if you're publishing the photographs and the names of the guy who questioned you in the Tomsk police station, so that, I guess that gives you a sense of how confident he is.
Yeah.
And you know, more power to him. I mean, I guess he believes that, you know, he doesn't, you know, he has nothing to fear in this case because he's simply publishing the documents that he has rightfully procured, at least as far as we know. I haven't seen any evidence to the contrary. Calling people murderers or complicit in murders, that could be the one element that's kind of more questionable.
What does he do for a living?
He's a designer.
Okay.
Yeah, he works as a designer.
Like Adobe Photoshop and InDesign?
Not quite sure.
Like digital design? Like he's at his computer or he's what's he designing? Any idea?
I haven't actually answered that question, but on his website, he doesn't call himself a designer. He calls himself a lobbyist and influencer, which suggests that his, suggests that his work and this project that he's been, working on for the last 9 years is kind of the thing that he's most passionate about. And I think if you speak to him, that definitely comes across.
Gotcha.
Very clearly. I haven't had a chance to make it out to Tomsk yet, but we have spoken, and I think it would be a very interesting case to follow for sure if it reaches trials.
He sounds like a unique individual. So
yeah, I think he definitely is. I mean, he's very. I mean, you know, these kinds of criminal charges, especially if you're facing two legal cases, you know, you may quieten down a bit. I can give you another funny detail, which really gives you an impression of what kind of person Denis Karagodin is. So the Tomsk branch of Russia's investigative committee, which I guess is kind of rough equivalent to the FBI, they launched this competition. I think one part of the competition is, who can submit a piece of artwork that is, you know, most positive about the investigative committee or something like that. And then the other one is, a piece of artwork or some kind of project that most faithfully puts across the image of a Russian investigator.
Okay.
Right. So Denis Karagodin, he submitted his website and his 8-9 year project to the investigative committee for this project.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, I think that's not quite accurate. What he submitted is these photos of the people who are questioning him, these kind of modern day police officers, these photos and their biographical details and the details that he's published about the case. He submitted that to the investigative committee's competition, which the website post that actually announces competition looks like it was something kind of made for school kids, as in like competition for school kids. But anyway, he submitted part of his website to that saying, you know, my website should be one of the leading competitors for a project that kind of, how can I say this, depicts a modern day Russian investigator. So I asked him if this was simple trolling, but I think he's quite serious about it. And that may just be because, again, he wants to draw more attention to his case. But he said, yeah, we're definitely hoping for a victory.
All right, good.
That's my interview with Matthew Luxmore, a Moscow-based correspondent for RFERL. Thank you for listening, everybody, and extra thanks to those of you who are still contributing to the show at patreon.com/KevinRothrock. Until next time, everybody.
Говорят мы пеки-буки, как выносит нас земля. Дайте, что ли, карты в руки, погадать на короля.